This is Bird Note. Rosalie Barrow Edge famously said, "The time to protect a species is while it is still common." She was one of the 20th century's most outspoken advocates for birds and the creator of the world's first refuge for raptors. In the U.S., birds of prey were once fair game for farmers and sport hunters who believed that raptors were a threat to livestock. In 1929, Pennsylvania was one of several states that offered a cash reward for every goshawk killed. That drew bounty hunters to the Appalachian Mountains, where migrating eagles, falcons, and hawks died by the thousands. When Rosalie learned of the slaughter, she spearheaded a campaign to lease and later buy a ridgeline hunting ground that locals called Hawk Mountain. In 1934, newly hired game wardens made certain that raptors were no longer hunted for sport, but counted for science. Today, Hawk Mountain Sanctuary attracts hundreds of researchers and volunteers who work to ensure that birds of prey remain a common sight. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is dedicated to the memory of Nancy Nordhoff, whose legacy of tenacious support for environmental conservation and opportunities for women will last for generations to come.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me, as usual, is Brandon. And I've come across a work that I wasn't really aware of, which is kind of surprised me because it's actually quite well known. It's called The Didache. Now, for our listeners, I think to open the episode, it's important to have some history. So The Didache is technically, it's a heretical text. It is not an official, it's not in the Bible, basically. So, which means it was excluded from the official canon of the Christian religion. It's also, the Didache is also widely considered by scholars to be one of, if not the earliest Christian text that we have surviving today. There's a lot of controversy around that, but there is no controversy around is that it is a very early text. When you get into studying like early Christianity and the formation of the Christian church, a lot of people are actually quite interested in this because you get into things like Gnosticism, and there's all sorts of people find out there's all these other gospels and books. It's not just Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There's the Gospel of Thomas, or the Gospel of Judas, or the Gospel of Mary. The formation of Christianity was a complex event that took place over centuries. And there was a lot of stuff written and circulated and a lot of different ideas. And the Christianity that we know today took literally centuries to form. And this is one of the earliest texts that we have from this sort of formation period. And it might even be as early as the Gospel of Mark. So for our listeners, there's three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're generally considered some of the earliest Christian texts. They're also, it's called the synoptic, meaning kind of same, because they all tell sort of the same story of Jesus's upbringing and life and works and stuff like that. And they're all considered to be quite early. And so early means late first century, early second century AD. So keep in mind, Jesus died in, 33 AD or something like that. So the earliest text is usually considered to be Mark, and most scholars put Mark in the late first century. So think 70, 80 AD. The Didache is also widely considered to be written around that time as well. And it actually has, particularly from Matthew, some passages which are very similar to passages found in those really early texts as well. But why we wanted to read this text on air is because it's not unlike the synoptic gospels, which are really, really basically like little life stories of Jesus. Like this was the Christ and this is what he did. This is the earliest basically behavioral ethical text. This text was quite widely circulated. We know that because there's been a lot of surviving fragments. It was translated into a lot of it was translated into a lot of different languages that had converting Christians and stuff like that. So we know it was at one point in the kind of first, second, third, fourth century AD, very widely read. And it was basically a kind of how-to manual on being a Christian. And what's so interesting about that is there's basically a lot of ethical and moral dictates within the text that really show a new what I found so interesting about it was that it's basically like reading a text and seeing the birth of a new ethical system. And we'll talk a little bit about how, like, as we read through, that system is in comparison to the world that this system is coming up in, which is the Greco-Roman world, the Homeric world, a pagan world, as we call it, although it's obviously way more complicated than that. And so you basically have a whole new ethical moral system that's sort of arriving on the scene that is wildly different than the other systems and ways of thinking that are surrounding it.
This will be really interesting to kind of read from that perspective in particular, from the kind of comparative religious perspective, the comparative ethical perspective, but also even just from, you know, the straight up historical perspective. It's a very, I love getting my hands on and reading like very, very early texts, sort of like proto texts in a way like this, that prefigure a lot of what goes on and does end up becoming canonical in a way.
Yeah, and we should say that the Didache, it's widely considered that it was probably put together over a couple decades. Like it was basically like passed around as to new Christians and new Christian communities as they were formed, as people like the Apostle Paul and other early Christians went around sort of forming churches and converting people, because conversion, as we'll get in the text, is an important part of the religious system, of the ethical system, which is, you know, in itself an interesting and unique aspect of the system. And so you could kind of see it as like a manual that was left with these early groups, and also slightly modified and changed over the decades as this new religion kind of found its feet. But it's interesting because it's so early that it shows the Christian religion in its in effectively its earliest form, or one of its earliest forms. And by that measure, it means that it was written when either some of the 12 apostles were still alive, or at the very least, people who knew the apostles directly were still alive. So basically, you know, you have this very close relationship still with like degrees of separation with people who actually ostensibly knew Jesus Christ, or were there and witnessed those events and were with him and, you know, were part of that sort of like initial movement, right? It's early enough that you actually have people who have this extremely close relationship to, you know, the original guy, which, you know, we would presume would be like the most Christian, you know, like, Christ himself, right? So in that way, it's really interesting. So we're gonna read, and as we go through, we'll kind of discuss different things. There are aspects just for our listeners as well. It's easy to find online. It's spelled Didache. There are aspects of the text that we're gonna skip over because some of them are more practical. It's, you know, it goes into how to properly do like a Eucharist, or how to properly do a baptism, although there might be things to be said about that. The primary things we're going to focus on are kind of more the first part and then the very last part as well, which go into the ethical teachings and then a sort of ontological overall perspective or, you know, espoused world view that, again, is really interesting and is a huge leap in evolution in terms of, like, what is, like, basically going on in the world, how people perceive themselves and, you know, their position in things and time. There are two ways, one of life and one of death. And there is a great difference between the two ways. The way of life is this. First, you shall love God who made you. And second, love your neighbor as yourself and do not do another what you would not want done to you. So I think we have to pause, like, right at the beginning and just say, you know, so there's two ways, the way of life, the way of death. So basically, this is an ethical system, a worldview where you're like kind of either you're either on board or you're not. Right. Like is the kind of the immediate proposition put towards you. And then the first commandment, you shall love the God that you made you, is very similar, actually, in structure to Exodus 25, which is, you know, the first commandment, you know, loving God is, you know, the primary thing, right? You're like, you shall have no other idols above me, or, you know, however it's usually translated. First of all, it's a monotheistic religion. There's one God. And the primary, the number one tenet within this religion, the very opening thing is that you are to love this God more than anything else. This is a hinge point that everything else obviously comes afterwards. But it's also a relationship that was not expected of people at the time in their relationship to other gods and religious groups and stuff like that, right? To have just one God and have your whole life be committed to that God was not something that was, like, normally expected of your, like, average Roman citizen.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's really interesting kind of, I mean, it makes a lot of sense that you would want to start with basically your most, like, applicable kind of maxims, as it were. So there's three things that you should do. We start off actually with these two ways, which, in a thinking about it from, like, a comparatively philosophical perspective, makes me think of, like, Parmenides or something like that. You know, there's the way of being and the way of non-being, but you can't actually take the way of non-being, so there's just the way of being. Here, there really actually are two ways you could go. There's the way of life and there's the way of death. And you really could go to the way of death. And later, I think we'll get to what you have to do if you take that later on.
The way of life and the way of death, it should probably be read, at least to me, would be read almost literally, in the sense of the sort of bargain that's being made in the early Christian view is that, like, eternal life of some kind is being offered to you if you, like, join on the side of God. So when they say there's a way of life and there's a way of death, and we'll get more into this, especially as we get into the kind of, like, the ontology of this early Christian world. You literally could live in some sense forever, right? Like, if you're a proper Christian, but if you don't, then you're going to die. It's also important to note that, like, I don't think, to my knowledge, that conceptions of hell and damnation in that kind of way were really a part of the picture yet. And instead, what you have probably is a holdover of, like, the Jewish view, which was, like, the Sheol, or if I'm doing the pronunciation, which is, like, the kind of, like, a shadow world, or the kind of, like, underworld view of, like, the pagan, which is, again, this sort of, like, shadowy, you don't really exist anymore, but you kind of do. And in many pagan religions as well, it's like death is, like, you are just death. Like, there isn't really an afterlife. When they're offering life, they literally are offering, like, a never-ending and eternal existence versus some form of destruction. But it shouldn't necessarily be seen as hell. I think that's a later conception that these early Christian individuals would not have subscribed to or wouldn't have been an idea at that time.
Yeah, it's more or less, like, I don't think they would have like conceived it in as technical terms as like annihilationism or something like that. It's like a very pre-critical kind of annihilationism, just like the very intuitive fear that one feels when you're threatened with death, and you could avoid that. What's on offer here is like, because like a life that ends in death is just death, but a life that is lived forever, that's true life, right? And what's on offer here, I think, as well, is not just this idea of like eternal life, but the fact that you get to, and this will go into like the communal and the practice, so the sort of like practices of what it means to be a Christian, you actually get to live not just this life fearing death, and so you don't really get to live life at all because you're fearing all these things and getting wrapped up in all these problems. But since you don't have to worry about death because you've been offered eternal life, you actually get to live life, you know, you get to enjoy it and you get to live with people and whatnot.
Yeah.
And we'll go into what the tenets of those look like.
To move on to the next one, so this is 1.3. The meaning of these sayings is this: bless those who curse you and pray for your enemies and fast for those who persecute you. For what reward is there for loving those who love you? Do not the heathens do the same? But you should love those who hate you, and then you shall have no enemies. So I think if we're going to like pause like early on with any sort of ethical, so this is obviously espousing an ethical system, right? And this ethical system really is, I think, in opposition with the pagan and Roman, like the Roman, basically the Roman world, the imperial Roman world, which was still very much a Homeric tradition, you know, where you have values of honor and reputation and loyalty and duty, fate, morality, like competition. You know, there's this expectation in you know, the Roman world, in you know, the kind of morality of the day, like great people do great things, right? Like, you know, and the gods favor those who are, you know, great in battle or have, you know, are who demonstrate great strength or intelligence, right? Immediately my mind is drawn to Nietzsche. Like we've talked about Nietzsche before, this is probably one of his most famous ideas, this idea of slave morality. And you can kind of see where this comes in here. You know, when they say bless those who curse you and pray for your enemies, you know, this is a morality that's basically says like, do no harm, do no hate, do no, like, if you are attacked, don't attack back. If people hate you, love them in return. If people want to take over your life and take your stuff and hurt and harm you, then like, basically, you know, pray for them, right? Like, you know, pray for their souls. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the Nietzsche perspective of this, obviously the anthropology of morality is, you know, like these Christians, many of them are primarily lower status individuals, right? Especially early on, and especially, you know, as Christianity forms in the Eastern, you know, Roman world, you have individuals who are either slaves or low status persons or whoever within the hierarchy of the Roman system who, you know, this sort of system rings more true to, right? Like this is a ethical and moral worldview that is more in line with the actual life world that these people are inhabiting at the time.
Yeah, it kind of speaks to a particular class of people who are subject to certain things, who live in certain circumstances, and who are practicing something that at the time is essentially forbidden, right?
At the end of the section, you should love those who hate you, and then you shall have no enemies, right? Like, the idea of having enemies was in many senses like a positive thing. All through the Roman world, you know, there were cults to, you know, Alexander the Great, or there were cults to, you know, Odysseus, or cults to Augustus, and the, you know, the imperial cults and all this kind of stuff. You know, all these individuals, you know, were defined by their enemies, were defined by their conquests, were defined by their power and victory and all that kind of stuff. And this is basically a complete rejection of having enemies in the first place, right? Like, having enemies is a sin. It's bad. This is turning that on its head.
Yeah, even explicitly in the text, there is like a division between the practicing Christian here and the heathens. For what reward is there for loving those who love you? Do not the heathens do the same? I mean, the heathens are the people who sort of subscribe to, you know, hate who you hate and love who you love. But Christians are going to practice something very different, which is turning that right on its head and sort of turning the logic against itself, that there's a certain kind of ontological priority to love, that hate begets hate, and it just sort of cycles around. But if your love is powerful enough, and I mean, if you're a Christian, you've got the most powerful love in existence on your side, you have God, that can overcome hate.
The Christian religion, you know, immediately one of the defining features is that any person, like literally any human being, is a child of God. There is only one God. Any person is a child of God. And therefore, even if that person is a heathen or acting wrongly or is being immoral or hurting you or whatever, they are in some sense still a semblance of God. They're still a semblance of Christ, that they're, you know, the individual who Christ sacrificed himself for ostensibly on the cross for their sins or whatever. You know, and you have to, by loving everybody, you are also loving God, because you love all of God's creation. You love all of God's children, no matter who they are. That there's conditions on that love. And this is another way in which we see this shift. So now we move to our next section. Abstain from fleshy and bodily lust. If someone strikes your right cheek, turn the other also and be perfect. Again, that's obviously from the Bible. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go two. If someone takes your cloak, give you a cloak. If someone takes from you what is yours, don't ask for it back. You really cannot. There's no room for conflict here. But the biggest point, or one of the biggest points, is that right at the beginning, abstain from fleshy and bodily lust. It'll get more into this as the text goes on. The Roman world was obviously a more sexually open, fluid place. It's a mistake to think that the Roman world was just like, I think there's sometimes this vision that it's like this was just one giant like orgy party all the time. The Roman world was actually in many ways relatively conservative around stuff like sexuality, or could be depending on the era and the region and all that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, sexuality and acceptance around sexuality was far more permissive. You know, and different forms of sexuality were also much more allowed, and it was, you know, it was much less of a taboo. We are seeing the introduction of sexuality as an ethical problem, as a moral problem. This is, I think, that's going to have huge implications through human history. You know, is turning sexuality into an issue of ethics, which is a quite uniquely Christian in comparison to the world that, you know, this is inhabiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I almost shouldn't bring this up just because I haven't really read the text at all, but I know that this very topic is, I've like nosed through it, but I haven't engaged with it. This, one of the things that Foucault talks about in his history of sexuality is the very kind of subjectivizing of one's sexuality, that you have a relationship. It's not just that you are subject to these things, but Christianity introduces the fact that you have a relationship with your sexuality, with your desires and whatnot. And that you had to cultivate that, you know, and that is a reflection of your virtue, of your character.
There's almost like a little bit of this, I'm trying to think about how to phrase it, but there's almost a little bit of like a Cartesian kind of perspective that's starting to go on within the Christian worldview, because the Christian way of life, although it's very communal, also becomes very personal in one's relationship with God, which also then, you know, you'll see in other aspects, basically personal conscience around one's actions and one's ethical standing becomes something of concern, right? Like, and that's not to say that like Romans, you know, the average Roman citizen and people like that didn't have a conscience, but I don't think that there was the same level of this expectation of one's consistent sort of self-reflection and self-chastising in the face of like hard and fast rules. And I think that the Christianity really brings that to the fore, that like now I'm someone who has to be reflective on my, like, okay, what does my actual relationship with God look like? And how are those actions taken out? And also too, like if I behave poorly, if I give in to, you know, like lusts of the body or whatever, then this is also now my guilt, right? Like I have a trend, like there's a transgression that is deep with, is in within the deepest part of my soul. Whereas like from my understanding, again, there's a lot of variation, but in the general pagan Roman world, like the gods don't really care. Like about like these, like in most cases, these are not like the gods take very specific interest in very specific individuals. And it's a very narrative driven sort of relationship in that kind of way. But you as an individual, just some random person living in this time, don't really like the gods aren't concerned with your activities in that kind of way.
Yeah. Or even if they are, I mean, usually you're sort of affiliated with a god or a goddess that is supposed to be sort of, I guess not like yours, like you own a god or anything, but the one that you're affiliated with. I'm thinking of this instance in the Odyssey where, you know, Odysseus is not like, you know, he's the trickster and whatnot. He can do anything to get out of anything. But this is something that is kind of like morally ambiguous. But that's the thing, is like that's kind of morally ambiguous from our perspective, because we kind of have this like ethic where you can kind of square an action against a particular circumstance. But if you actually look in the Odyssey, the god, like Athena, who is essentially the person who presides over and really cares about Odysseus, thinks it's awesome, you know? She, like, there's the scene where he washes up on Ithaca and she's disguised as like a little farmer boy, and he says Ithaca, because he like, that's where he's returning to. He basically says Ithaca, and then Athena turns back. Athena is the farmer boy. She turns into Athena. And Athena gives him a big hug and says, "You bottomless bag of tricks. You're so awesome." This thing that, you know, basically like there is, to kind of harken back to what you're saying with Nietzsche, there is not a slave morality, but there's a master morality where our features, the things about us, are reflected in our culture, are celebrated in our gods and goddesses, you know?
Individuals is very well known in the Roman world and stuff like that. They would have relationships with specific gods or goddesses of their household. And the sorts of things that they would be concerned with, though, aren't so much, it's like bringing honor and success and wealth to your home, to your clan. These are all like outward worldly actions that have some reflection and are very much like reflected again in honor. Like honor is a big word. Like and other people knowing that you did this. Whereas the Christian morality is bringing in a very private relationship with oneself and with God, where now, like, actually I'll go through. I'm going to jump down to section 2.2. And it's basically a list of rules. Do not commit murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not corrupt boys. I presume that's against, you know, having homosexual relations. Do not have illicit sex. So any sex outside of marriage or whatever it would be. Do not steal. Do not practice magic. Do not practice witchcraft. You shall not murder a child. I guess that one's good. Whether it be born or unborn. And do not covet things of your neighbor. Again, so now you're having all these sorts of rules that are put upon you. These are negations. These are things that you can't do. So rather than it being about like how a system about how triumphantly you can be, this now becomes a system of rule following. And how perfect can you follow this system of rules? And if you break these rules, like, you will know and God will know. And so now you have that kind of special relationship, whereas previously, again, it's, you know, the gods are more concerned with you. Like, did you do cool stuff? Were you successful? Were you like a badass in some kind of way? Were you a smart businessman? Did you bring honor and wealth to your family and clan, et cetera, et cetera? Now it's about falling.